Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Long-term trends, and the way forward for the Navy Marine Corps team and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody, for the Battle of Midway and D-Day edition of MidRats. I'm your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander, and my usual co-host, Eagle One, I think has finally found out where the ones and zeros and the on switch are. He should be joining us shortly from Eagle Speak. As a reminder, those who are live, make sure and join the chat room at the bottom of the show page. The usual suspects will be there, and you'll also find our second guest milling around smartly in case you wanted to tease some things up for the second half of the show. Eagle One, once we get him on board, which he should be here about right now, he'll be riding herd on the chat room. So let's go ahead and move forward. When you look at, for those that saw the advertisement for the show, when we look forward here halfway through 2010, you know, where does the Navy Marine Corps team find itself? And one thing that has really joined the conversation here recently, you can kind of put a pin at it in the first week in May, is there are discussions about the reality of the defense budget when it comes to the fiscal realities that are becoming more and more apparent that are going to be here in the future. And Secretary of Defense Gates, in very fine fashion, he's come out and he has started that conversation. But this isn't anything new from the Navy, and it's nothing really drastic at this point, but I think the conversation starting earlier is really important. And we also see that we have non-traditional actors coming on board and challenging just a fundamental exercise of naval power. Most recently, the incidents off of Gaza. But this has a long history, and there have been some developments recently that adds a little different angle to it, and that's what we're going to talk about here today. Familiar challenges, budget priorities, and the enemy finding clever ways to turn one nation's power against itself. These can be taken care of like they've been taken care of before. It just requires good leadership, good thought, good planning, and finding a way to explain things to the taxpayer and to Congress so they'll understand the challenge the way that people who live and breathe in the Navy part of the national security environment can understand well. And our guests to discuss these challenges are going to be MidRats quasi-regulars, Brian McGrath and Claude Barabe. For our first guest, we're going to bring Brian McGrath on board. He is a retired Navy commander, and right now he is functioning as the founding director of Deltex Consulting Studies and Analysis. Is a division of Deltex Systems Incorporated, headquartered in lovely Vienna, Virginia. It's kind of a niche consultancy. He specializes in defense and national security issues, including strategy, strategic planning, executive communications, and strategic communications. Brian spent 21 years on active duty, including the tour and command of the USS Bulkley, DDG 84, guided missile destroyer, homeported in Norfolk, Virginia. His final duties ashore included serving as team lead and primary author of the 2007 maritime strategy that we're all familiar with, titled A Cooperative Strategy for the 21st Century Sea Power. He also hosts his own blog talk radio format radio show and a blogs under the same name, Conservative Wahoo. Brian, welcome back to MidRats.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good deal. Just to kick things out of the park here, this Friday, we saw over at The Hill an article by Roxana Tyron about the Pentagon aims to find $100 billion in savings. And it kind of builds off of what we've seen for the last month, talking about where SecDef Gates wants to steer the conversation about the defense budget in general. I mean, there have been some people out there who think are kind of yelling a little bit too loud about it, because when you look at the details, he's asked for, I think you can call a pretty modest request. For instance, $100 billion over the next 5 years to maintain current fighting forces into modernized weapon systems. And he's really not talking about, at least from what I've read, cutting, but reallocating from whether it's overhead, something that I think is always kind of BS, but developing efficiencies, i.e. finding inefficiencies. That's a little too broad, I think. But from the Navy point of view, because we have been in the background of the war for the last 10 years, where do you see the little red dot coming in the Navy as we look to find an extra $100 billion to reallocate towards what the SecDef considers greater priority?
Well, first of all, I think the Secretary should be congratulated in trying to find efficiencies and to looking to the department to bear some of the burden of the financial situation that the country finds itself in. If you distribute $100 billion in savings across a five-year fit-up of $600 billion apiece, you're really subtracting $100 billion from a total of $3 trillion. And that under that circumstance, it's not quite as difficult to take. Then you split that $100 billion into five-year chunks among three services and a defense establishment, and you get down to numbers that are insurmountable to deal with. And I think the Navy can count on a good deal of headquarters consolidations. I think the Navy can look forward to fewer contractors helping active duty people do their work on a daily basis. I don't know necessarily that this is that this is going to cut appreciably into either acquisition or operations and maintenance. I think it's pretty much going to come out of headquarters and contracting.
Eagle One.
What would happen if we cut out all the non-warfighting training stuff, all the, are you too fat programs, all the, some of the, for want of a better word, equal opportunity programs? How much money could we save if we cut all that stuff out and just concentrated on the real mission of getting ready to fight wars?
Yeah, I don't know. I imagine in a $140 billion annual Department of the Navy budget or thereabouts, that the money spent on those sorts of things is pretty much it's not even worth – I don't even think it's really worth debating. I don't think that much goes into that. There's a lot of chatter that goes into it, and a lot of political hay is made about these kinds of things. But I'm not sure there's a great deal of money that gets spent on dealing with those issues. We are a reflection of the best of our society in the United States Navy. We're not a reflection of the entire society. We don't enlist people with mental or physical handicaps. We don't enlist the grotesquely obese. We try to reflect the best of the society, and as such, the maintenance of some standard is probably worthwhile.
Building off the discussion of personnel, I know a few weeks ago, Fleet Forces Command, Admiral Harvey, came out with a ping to his subordinate commands to look at personnel and to look at structures and look at efficiencies, taking the marching orders as he should from on high. He was the first really senior guy I saw that came out in a real public way. I mean, you have message traffic, but he used his blog over there to do that. And looking at what he was discussing, and then you can look back, the New York Times had an article that kind of began this conversation in some ways on the 16th of May, and they brought up something that when you look at the money, it's manpower. And one of my little hobby horses is the fact we have more flag officers than we actually have warships. But it said, and I quote here, Mr. Gates says he wants to trim the bloated civilian and military bureaucracy, and in parentheses, including excess admirals and generals, for a modest savings of $10 billion to $15 billion annually. And I think in a naval career, and Brian, I'm sure you saw it as well, that you often find yourself, if you're a recidivist staff weenie, that what value do you add and what does the guy next to you add? You're really just an intermediary between point A and point B. We have a regular commenter on my spot, Commodore 14, retired U.S. Navy captain, former Commodore, and he talks about his staffing level as a DESRON commander back in the 90s, and you look at the size of a DESRON now, and there's just a huge bloat there. Do you see, without much of a hue and cry, that we would be able to, at the end of this conversation about manpower, take a serious look at the number of BANNP that we have for flag officers and flag officer staff and try to cut some of that off the top, for, if for no other reason than to lead to the front and seriously look at, you know, beyond headquarters consolidation and to go beyond getting rid of some contractors to really seriously attack that tail versus teeth ratio that we've come to?
You know, I think I am less on a jihad to cut flag officers than others. A lot of times we are forced into flag officers by Congress, who tells us you need to have a flag officer that runs this particular this or this particular that. And I think we could probably cut half our flag officers, and it would be a rounding error in terms of what gets saved compared to some of the costs that are that drive us when you talk about manpower, like medical costs. You know, since 1989, the Navy has cut from about half a million people down to 370,000 people. The Navy has cut from 574 ships to 289 ships or thereabouts. Our personnel costs for significantly smaller Navy have gone through the roof, and this is paying for every bit of what we have determined it takes to keep faith with sailors, retirements, medical care for the sailor and their families, retirement medical care. That is what is destroying our ability to acquire, equip, and operate our forces to the extent that they need to be operated. When we talk about manpower costs, it's not, I'll give you 100 admirals, you can have them. Cut 100 admirals off the list. It's not worth talking in terms of a total savings. We have to have fundamental reform in the way we compensate, in the way we take care of sailors and their families in the decades going forward without breaking faith with those who signed contracts that said, this is what I'm going to get.
Eagle One.
Well, I mean, isn't that the $100 billion question? What are those reforms that are fundamental that we have to make?
Well, I don't know about you all, but I mean, I'm a military retiree. I am a TRICARE Prime guy. I think my annual premium is about $275 or maybe $300. I pay single. It is nice that the American people and the Congress wish to provide me with my medical care for that figure, but I didn't sign a contract that said I would have, you know, $275 HMO medical care for the rest of my life. I think my medical care at the taxpayer's expense is probably too cheap for what I get for it. I think we should look seriously at the way we compensate people that come into the Navy from here on out. We should look at what exactly we promise them in terms of medical care. We could say, you know, we could perhaps tie Mr. Gates seems all upset that I get to have military health care take care of me when my company could easily do it. But as long as I have the option, I'm not going to choose to do that. Well, you know, maybe with future military retirees, you remove that option. There's a whole slew of things we could do to get at some of those costs, but they all cut at the heart of an increasingly entitlement-minded American public who seem to think that, you know, we have it coming to us, and it's a tough, tough political fight to tell people that, you know, you don't have it coming to you. or you did once and you can't have it anymore.
Yeah, that's a perfect tee up into one of my favorite questions I like to ask. And I've mentioned on this show before, one of my great moments of pride is at the Millblog Expo when they had the manpower and benefits panel up there. They refused to answer my question. And that is exactly what you're talking about, Brian, is the manpower cost. Let's focus on the retirees. I know exactly what you make in retirement pay, more or less, because I have about the same. The issue is you look at what we get. And you look at, and let's benchmark comparables. And everybody talks about the European socialist state. So I always say, okay, let's do that. Let's talk about the Dutch military, the German military, the French military. What are their retirement benefits and their retirement pay? And a lot of the European militaries, you can leave and retire the military when you're 42, 43. But you know what? You're not getting a retirement paycheck until, depending upon your country, you're in your 50s or maybe even 60s. Their health care is nowhere close to we are. And I think, you know, you brought up an interesting point about a entitlement mentality. When without going through the details, I'm sure you had a similar experience. When I came out the other end of my VA physical, I was kind of shocked at some of the things that they give credit for physically that happens. And that is a huge impact. And I know there's a comeback to a lot of people saying, well, the World War II generation is going to die, so we'll save money. That's been disproved long ago. So when that conversation starts to take place, do you see, Brian, as a no-go, and I think you've already implied this, it's a no-go to do any retroactive changes where everybody who's retired all of a sudden is going to see a cut in benefits, but somebody that signs the paper January 1st, 2013 is going to have a significantly different package on the other end than somebody who retired the year before, something like that?
Well, I mean, I think, I'm a political junkie, and I generally tend to deal in what's the doable. I see retroactive cuts as less palatable, very unpopular, and probably not without a constituency in Congress. I think reducing benefits for folks that sign up certainly something that Congress would chew on.
Eagle One.
Well, as a retired reservist, I'm pretty familiar with the benefits not kicking in until you hit age 60, which, you know, now that I'm 60, is a pretty useful thing. But how does that look? How would that sell down the road? And would it really save that much money? I mean, we're looking, you guys are much younger than I am, obviously, but is that a viable alternative?
Well, will it solve all problems? No. I think you'd need to look at a series of things. You'd have to, first of all, have the conversation is the maintenance of a world-class military in our national interest? If you believe so, push letter A. If not, push B. If you believe so, then are you willing to pay for it? Push A, push B. And I think we come out at the other end of this conversation with a sense that it costs a lot of money to be the top dog if you want to have the top military in the world. If you want to pay people less than they're worth for their entire active duty career, you have to defer some of that income to retirement. I mean, I remember distinctly as captain of a destroyer, 315 people, billion-dollar warship, and a $20 million budget every year. And the military, and I was getting paid about $100,000 a year. I mean, I got to tell you, in the civilian world, that kind of responsibility would get me significantly more than that. But, you know, you stay in the Navy because you love what you do and because there is this sense that you're going to get taken care of later. You have this compact that you go back to. Let's face it, the military changed the compact with guys of my vintage when they offered the high three, when they went from the 50% to the high three, and then the redux retirement. I mean, so it's possible to do things in midstream. It's just politically difficult. But you know, none of this is going to be easy, and none of it's going to be particularly popular. Best way to do it, though, is start with the people who haven't signed up yet.
Yep, I think the the whole manpower and taking money out of pockets, that's a longer term budgetary fix, and it's going to be a lot more hard to do and painful politically. But let's go to something that's probably a little bit easier. And if the SecDef wants to reallocate those funds, the easiest thing to do is something that, at least as a young JO, I remember with significant attention to detail, when Dick Cheney was SecDef, he got pissed off at the heavy attack, canceled the A-12. He got pissed off at Lockheed Martin, and I believe he was the one that canceled what was then the P-7. And there's a whole series of times where you just got to cancel programs when you need to get money. We saw that with the Crusader and the Army and the Future Combat System. And the Air Force recently, everybody's fighting over the F-22. When you look at the Navy, and the easy way to get money is to cancel programs, what is the Navy version of the F-22? I think the DDG-1000 was already cooked in the books. There's something else out there that if you need to get B in billions and significantly in the next few years, I think the only way you're going to be able to do that is to kill a program. And again, you have to get Congress to say you can have 9 by 11 aircraft carriers. There's really no low-hanging fruit. In the next 5 years, where is some fruit that SecDef Gates could grab hold of?
Well, the first thing I want to do is tell you that I will have this conversation with a digital gun to my head, because I'm on record fairly stridently that the Secretary of Defense is his eye looking towards the Navy is misplaced. It's dramatically misplaced. The United States of America spends plenty of money on defense. $600 billion a year is plenty. We don't need more. However, it's spent poorly. We've had 4 or 5 QDRs, yet we still have about a 27, what is a 16 or 17 split among the services and the defense agencies. We do not have resource allocation following strategy. We have resource allocation following the political interaction of the services underneath the Secretary of Defense in a get along fashion. I want there to be a real debate that questions that funding paradigm. I want there to be a real debate that says, what is it we're going to rebuild this Army to do? What is it exactly that we wish to do with the Army other than rebuild it? I saw there's this wonderful article in the Weekly Standard this week called the Big Squeeze, Obama Underfunds the Military. And you read it, and they do this wonderful job of talking about how the Navy helps keep the security balance in Asia, demonstrates American resolve, takes care of the sea lanes of communication, all of those things. Then they move their eye to the Army, and they basically talk about, well, we need to rebuild the Army. There's no compelling narrative. There's nothing out there right now that convinces me that we should be allocating that money to rebuild that Army in the fashion that it was before it started these wars.
Who in Congress?
Now, to answer your go ahead.
Who do you see in Congress taking the point from just that point of view that you articulated there? Who in Congress is the best voice? Because honestly, I don't hear one out there.
I think it's Jim Webb. I honestly think at the end of the day, and this kills me because I'm a pretty partisan Republican and I'm not a big fan of Jim Webb, but when I listen to him and when I watch him, he really is a John McCain likes to call himself a maverick, but he's a maverick. And I think he gets the contribution of sea power and land power from the sea, also known as the Marine Corps. I think he gets that we are a republic that has leadership responsibilities around the world, and the best way that we will be able to execute them is with a strategy that emphasizes sea power. I think Jim Webb could ultimately be it. Rob Whitman in the House is pretty articulate. I think Gene Taylor may be just a little bit strident and maybe sometimes seen as just a cutout for shipyards.
A little parochial.
Yeah. But you know, in answer to your question about low-hanging fruit, you know, I think we do a poor job of building ships. We do a poor job of creating a requirement, maturing that requirement, holding the design process the feet to the fire so that there's a mature design before before the contract is bid. I think the contracting process is broken. There's all sorts of things that people much smarter than I can speak to. But at the end of the day, I kind of think we have a relatively good plan for the mix of ships. I personally would like to see something smaller and built in numbers than the LCS. You know, I don't have any real heartburn with the boxes, as Bob Wirt calls them. The boxes are fine. You know, I have a problem with our ability to build those and acquire those boxes in an intelligent fashion. I think the team that's over there now and the Navy staff and the Secretariat has turned the corner to some extent on this, but we'll see. I think the LCS down select will be a big step in the direction as to whether they've got their, you know, this under control or not.
Eagle One.
Well, if you think that the, I'm a little confused by what you just said, I guess.
Sure.
You think
sure.
We have the right mix of ships, but we don't have enough ships, or we need more small ships, but we need them to be less expensive.
All right. Now here's. I'm sorry. I should be more clear. There is. I don't have a big problem with any of the ship classes we're building right now or that we're fielding right now. You know, I don't look a lot. There are a lot of people out there who hate LCS. I don't hate LCS. I think LCS has a bright future. I don't think it's going to be as a pull a module out, stick a module in kind of ship. But I think my sense is eventually there'll be one module per ship and it'll be that kind of ship. I would like to see a smaller class of ship, a presence corvette of some kind that we build in great numbers, 100, 150. It's only going to get there if we get more money in Navy shipbuilding, and that's only going to happen if I and others like me are successful in questioning the iron paradigm of funding.
Well, I guess the follow-on to that is if we, you know, we first talk about the number of people problem and then the issue of needing more ships. And I know that Captain Hughes addressed this in the new Navy thing that I call, title I always forget, you know, that if you build
new
a number
fighting
of smaller
–
there you go, new Navy fighting machine. If you build a number of smaller ships that you can still keep the personnel side about the same size. You don't think he had significant numbers on the personnel side, but – I'm curious whether that will really work by the time we get done with staffs and training and all that other stuff. What's your view on that?
I am not a good numbers analyst. That Bob worked always did that very well when he was on this side of the fence. Although when I looked at Wayne Hughes's numbers in the new Navy fighting machine, even I, as a history major, non-analytical type, I looked at it and shook my head and thought, you know, this doesn't add up. I thought his estimates for the cost of the SSBNs were just ridiculously low. I think his personnel, the numbers of personnel he sees to man these ships were insufficient. I think the Navy that he describes in the new machine is more expensive than he estimated, but I think the Navy that he describes in the new Navy fighting machine is worth thinking about.
You mentioned the SBNX, and it's something I keep touching on because I just look at when we're due to recapitalize the ballistic missile submarine force, and also kind of move the pixels back and look a lot at our national budgetary challenge and the trends that we're going in. The 2020s are going to be painful in the extreme. Let's just use as a benchmark. We can all argue about the cost of a ship that nobody's even seen yet. But back on the 16 May, they threw out a figure that I've seen before of $7 billion each for the ballistic missile submarines. And if you look at what the UK has gone through, that's about half of the shipbuilding budget, assuming everything remains the same, which of course it won't. When you're talking about smaller ships and perhaps a little more affordable ships,
if that much of a block is going to be dedicated for a period of time for shipbuilding, how do we bridge that without somebody's shipyard going to the red to the point that it drops off? I mean, are we really putting ourselves in a danger for our strategic infrastructure to actually build ships after the 2020s?
If the Navy has to pay the bill, the total bill for the SSBN follow-on, and it comes out of what appears to be about a $15.9 billion average annual shipbuilding budget, we will decline. The Navy will decline. We cannot possibly get to where the shipbuilding plan wants to get with that bill in the mix. So I think ultimately the Navy is going to have to make some hard choices, or the country's going to have to make some hard choices. I personally think 12 SSBNs with, you know, each with 20 or, you know, multiple independent retargetable vehicles is a little overkill in the nuclear world that we face today. I get away with fewer SSBNXs, but, you know, the R&D money to build one of those things still gets spread across fewer platforms, as you see in the DDG 1000 right now, and it drives unit costs up pretty damn high. We're in a world of hurt if the SSBNX has to come totally out of our pocket, and there is no relief on the top end of the Navy shipbuilding budget. I can make a case, and I'm going to make this case. I'm going to write all summer long, and I've started a group called Sea Power for America. We're going to get a lot more active and a lot more vocal in the months and in the year to come. I can make a pretty good case for a $22 or $23 billion a year shipbuilding budget. And if that money comes out of the ground forces, so be it, because I frankly don't understand what it is. There is no compelling narrative to rebuild the Army to the place it was before. And I only say that because the Army hasn't made it itself. And when the Army makes that narrative, then perhaps I'll take issue with it, but they don't even have it yet.
I don't know where Fib went. I think you're right. So I look forward to seeing more about your new rebuild the Navy program.
Can I say one more thing before I go? Because I think I have to give up the guest spot to Claude Barrabee.
Absolutely.
I want to talk about this this concept of preponderance. Secretary Gates he's used the statistic many times in speeches about how we are bigger than the next umpteen navies, umpteen of which are allies of ours. I think he profoundly misses the importance of our naval preponderance. Our naval power is part and parcel of our national, our global power. It's what gives us the right to call ourselves the global leader. It is what keeps friends and allies from entering into wasteful and dangerous naval arms races. There is a value unto itself of overwhelming naval preponderance. Others may call it free riding, call it what you will, but it is part of what keeps the system going. We talked about the global system in the maritime strategy. I'm going to continue to write and think and talk about this, that we had a magnificent, giant, perfect, beautiful, awesome land army that was fought to a standstill in Iraq for 4 years by insurgents. That was fought to a standstill in Afghanistan for a few years. It's a tough thing to spend all that money on a land force that is as preponderant as what you get for paying for that in the Navy. It just doesn't equal. It's not an equal proposition, and we have to stop kidding ourselves that it is.
Well, with that, I don't know what happened to Salamander, and I can't bring Quad in myself. We could just keep going, Brian. We'll
sure.
give us some other thoughts you have.
Well, I watch the Navy. I have clients that are in the Navy. I'm still very much associated with it, and I see hardworking people thinking through incredibly hard problems. But as I wrote in proceedings last month, the system in which they make those arguments, the Pentagon JSIDS process, the JROC process, the PPBE process, these are all processes that are designed to destroy service parochialism, to destroy service-based service-based infighting. That infighting, that joint approach to things, has made our military the most formidable fighting machine on the face of the earth, and it is, I am convinced, the most effective and most proper way to figure our fighting services. I just don't think that jointness is an effective strategic paradigm. I don't think it is an effective way to think about national strategy or the armed forces that are appropriate to the world's global power. We are siphoning away our national energy, our bandwidth, on trying to maintain a politically palliative for the services. You be quiet and I'll give you what you need. You be quiet and I'll give you what you need. And you be quiet and I'll give you what you need. The question is, what does the country need? What kind of country do we want to be? And what are the effects we wish to have around the world? And how do we wish our power to be demonstrated? Do we wish to be a power that can deter and defend? Or do we wish to be a power that is diminishing around the world because we are spending money on wasting assets? Dr. Krepinevich put a paper together recently where he talked about wasting assets, and he actually referred to carriers as wasting assets, and I would take great issue with that. I think the wasting asset right now is heavy land power. We don't have the places around the world to put it. We had a magnificent army, and we had to do something with it. When you have a magnificent, huge army, you have the ability to fight wars of choice. You don't fight wars of necessity. I'd like to see our national power go back to something more like a pre-World War II paradigm, where the army, a good bit of the army combat power resides in the National Guard. Much of what's on active duty is light and quick and highly mobile. And the day-to-day business around the world is done by the Navy and the Marine Corps. I think that kind of a military component of a national strategy is most optimized to continuing our global leadership.
Well, let's take that, because we're one of the topics we're supposed to discuss had to do with the current use by non-state actors of sea power. And we saw a really interesting asymmetric warfare situation going on with the Israelis and the Gaza flotilla as an example of that, where certainly non-state actors got involved and made what I think most legal authorities would say was a legal blockade. Looked like, turned it into what a lot of people have declared, although they're wrong, to be an act of piracy. How do we structure a Navy to deal with that?
And, hey, everybody, sorry about that. Hey, we had a power outage back in my war bunker here, so I had to reset everything. Thanks, Bill. I don't know if y'all are telling jokes or whatever while we're gone, but I'll tell you what.
I just told them your house was being raided by ICE. I don't.
Yeah. The CNO found out where I live. Oh, shit. Hey, I'll tell you what. Let's have this. To be fair to Claude, Brian, go ahead and answer Eagle One's question. Then we'll wrap it up and we'll turn it back over to Claude so he can get some airtime.
I think Claude is absolutely an expert on this kind of subject. I would only say that if you build a Navy around fighting pirates, you'll have 200 frigates. We need to be able to fight pirates. We need to be able to fight. We need to be able to influence events ashore. We need to be able to deter nuclear powers. We need to be able to do it all. That is the sine qua non of being the world's power, the world's superpower. And unless I missed the meeting, I think we still want to be that.
Okay. There we go. Hey, Brian, thanks for your, first of all, for coming on today. And thanks for your patience with our intermittent calling challenges, I think is a phrase we can use for it. And good luck with your ongoing discussions in the Beltway. And we hope to have you on again soon.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for your fancy footwork, Brian. I think you just won Dancing with the Stars.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, guys.
Have a good day. And everybody, just a quick reminder, in spite of your host's technical difficulties, you are still on Navy Milblog Radio Midrass. I'm Sal from the blog Commander Sidelander with my co-host, Eagle One, bravely filling in as I fell out of the breach. And for those that are interested, please check out our home blog, Eagle One. He's over at EagleSpeak. You can find me over at Commander Salamander. We also co-blog over at the United States Naval Institute's blog. And our second guest, who his shipmate stole 10 minutes of his airtime from, so that means we've got to have him on again, is a returning guest and a good friend of Midrats, Claude Barrabe. Claude is a lieutenant commander in the U.S. Naval Reserve. And we brought him on today to kind of build off of an article that came out recently from him in Small World Journal, Small
Wars. Uh-oh, Sal, are you gone again? Hey, Claude, can you hear me?
I can hear you okay.
Okay. Well, why don't you take up the discussion of the Israeli flotilla fight with the people trying to get stuff into the Gaza Strip. Is that just another example of an asymmetric warfare type situation?
Absolutely. It's a perfect example. And I had actually first briefly mentioned it in a Small Wars Journal article last year within a greater context, but focused on this in the past 5 or 6 months, and had finished writing it about 2 months, and just fortuitous that it happened to have been published just about the time that the attack happened. But I do think that this is a perfect example of where non-state actors and non-governmental organizations are using commercial platforms, international crews and passengers to score political points. What they're really doing is the fighting a PR war, and in some cases winning. The two examples that I had used in my article were an environmental NGO, Sea Shepherd, which most of your listeners should be familiar with. It's a television show on Animal Planet called Whale Wars, which follows Sea Shepherd, and these are the folks who go around chasing, ramming, and boarding the Japanese whaling ships in the southern seas. And the other case study I used was an NGO out of the Netherlands, Women on Waves, which has for the past 10 years provided abortion services off the coasts of countries which restrict or outlaw abortion in those specific countries, such as Poland, Ireland, and Portugal. And your listeners want to read that article, there's actually a very similar thing that happened with Gaza in terms of military use. When they ran their campaign, Women on Waves ran their campaign in Portugal, their ship, which had what they call an A-portable, it's a 10-by-20 facility for abortion services, and they were stopped by a Portuguese Navy ship. And I think one of the interesting side notes to that story is that the Portuguese corvette was her hull number was the 486, and 486, of course, is more commonly referred to as the abortion pill. I'm not sure if that was that was intended by the Portuguese or not, but certainly that did not go unnoticed by Women on Waves. So when you're looking at organizations like that, or if you're looking at the Free Gaza movement, you've got to remember what their primary goal is, and that's publicity. And just to piggyback off of what Brian was starting to discuss right before he left in terms of force structure, this may not necessarily be a force structure issue that we respond to. This may be in this type of warfare, we've got to address those other concerns, including PR, strategic communications. There are some cases, however, where we could develop commercial ships, which appear to be far more benign than using warships to challenge them.
Claude, this is Sal. I have moved to my backup systems, being my primary has destroyed everything. So through the glories of iPhone, Apple, feel free to sponsor the show. I've come back on board. Eagle One, thank you very much for filling in the gaps. Unless a cell tower dies, I shouldn't drop off and make everybody wonder what happened. Hey, I'm glad you started talking about some of the core parts of your article there in the Small Wars Journal. I just wanted to read in the second paragraph. I thought it really encapsulates everything that we're talking about in this particular area. I'll go ahead and read it for those that had a chance to. And quoting you, whether it is a bipolar or multipolar world, the fundamental conditions required of state-to-state relations are the same. Stable governments, systems of communications with one another, rules that guide the relations and enforcement mechanisms, whether they are economic, political, or military in nature. When any one or more of those operating systems are removed, the result is either anarchy or fault lines that pose security risk and be exploited by irregular forces. As we've seen in those circumstances on land, they might also be applied to maritime conditions. And what that made me think of is just what you alluded to, is we've seen in the last decade the ground forces have really looked at irregular warfare, psyops, info ops, strategic communications, and how that is affecting the kinetic operations that are going on. They're trying to leverage what traditional military structures they have to try to foil some of those attacks in those non-kinetic areas away, while also trying to push forward the mission. And these non-military structures at sea, I think are right in line with what you see, because there's nobody really that is organizing them all, and they're all pushed towards their same agendas.
Hello? Sure. Yeah, I'm sorry, Sal. What was the question?
The question is, if we're not going to have, there's no shipbuilding program to address that, is it really primarily a requirement to get a public affairs view of it and a strategic communications view of it and take the cost-benefit analysis of that? Do you lose more by going after these like the Israelis do than you would gain in security from a larger standpoint?
It's a combination of factors, and I would discuss a little bit of what you were talking about with Brian earlier in terms of force structure. Yes, piracy is, for example, a great example of a non-state actor using some of these tactics. Piracy is not a direct major threat to the United States. Certainly we have a responsibility as a global maritime power to protect sea lanes for legitimate commerce, but we're not going to build a force structure around that. That said, we could build ships, as Brian said, which are smaller in scale, maybe corvette size. And in fact, you guys were talking earlier about a savings of $10 to $15 billion annually. I didn't hear what that savings was from, but if you wanted to go with $100 or $200 million corvettes, clearly you would be able to build that 75 or 100 corvette force within the Navy. But certainly, shipbuilding or other platforms are not going to be the only answer to addressing the potential challenges that these NGOs present. It does mean a more robust public affairs. You have to get ahead of the story. I think that the Israelis did not do that. There's something called Preparation of the Battle Space, or IPB, and I think they could have prepared the battle space better. Now, certainly Israel is at a significant disadvantage because anything they do, any fact they present, will automatically be disregarded by many folks in the world, simply because there is real. You know, there are still people who believe that despite bin Laden's admission that he was responsible for 9/11, that the Israelis were. So they're at a disadvantage, but what they want to do is be able to reach out to that middle ground in the world, much like United States politics, where one party cannot win a general election without reaching out and appealing to the middle of America, that the independents or the unenrolled. So that needs to be a factor. So it is partially force structure. It is partially public relations. And it is also dealing with rules of engagement, which I don't know at this point what the discussions are within the Navy for addressing these, because I think this is a relatively new phenomenon in the maritime environment.
Eagle One?
Well, it may be a new the Israelis have been hitting these flotillas before, maybe didn't get much publicity because it was Cynthia McKinney and a few other nut jobs on board the vessels. But
sure.
What do we look – how could an enemy of the United States, whoever they are, use this sort of activity to – put us in the same position Israel in? You're damned if you do go after these people who may or may not be bringing weapons into your area, and you're damned if you don't, because if you let them in, then you're opening up your population to being bombarded potentially by more rockets. So,
right,
where's the threat come from for us?
Well, let's go back to the Gaza flotilla example for just a moment. I mentioned that they needed to do something about message development and shape that battle space, but they should have also, in addition to preparing for that, prevented the ability of the flotilla, which intended to run the blockade, and that's pretty clear, to use rather benign measures rather than maybe repelling in the early hours as they did. I think there have been some cases where they took out either engines or propellers or fouled propellers in the past. I'm not sure why they didn't do it this time. Maybe there wasn't an opportunity to do so. But even if you look now at the environmental NGO I mentioned earlier, Sea Shepherd, I think it's interesting to note that the Japanese whalers are now not only playing defense – they're not playing defense anymore with Sea Shepherd. They're now actually going on the offense, where they actually have one of their ships tracking the Sea Shepherd ship, and they're turning the hoses on them to try to damage their only helicopter. So I think there are some relatively benign activities that the Israelis or we could perform. But it goes back to a broader issue, and that's of maritime domain awareness. We need to certainly have a capability to understand these groups, these platforms, these people throughout the world. That now, granted, we have a whole lot of balls we're juggling. Whether it's rising competitors on the maritime commons or other issues, you know, what's happening off of North Korea with the Chonan. There are all these little potential hotspots throughout the world that we need to respond to. Is this a major priority? No, but I'm sure as heck, I'm sure that if we did have an NGO or somebody else, an NSA, who tried to, run into one of our ports, it certainly would become an issue overnight, just as with the Gaza flotilla. So I think in this case it's best to learn about the issue, analyze it, and see what we can learn from it and prepare for that contingency.
I think go ahead. You had a follow-on, Eagle One.
Well, yeah, years ago we had an exercise in which we used to play against some radical environmental organization trying to interfere with getting ships underway to go to sea. And I'm just thinking that, the concept has been around a while. I just wonder if we're addressing this at any level. I mean, are we studying the law of how to deal with these things, and what are our rights as far as going after these folks?
I don't know the answer to that. I'm sure there's some people we could ask, to see if this is something that they're looking at. I think if you look at the literature, that might be an indication, and I have to note that Eagle One is kindly contributing a chapter to a book that I'm editing on private market forces and their responses to terrorism, piracy, and other challenges in the 21st century. So I think, Eagle One, you'd agree that the legal literature out there was rather limited. So if the open source stuff is limited, then I think we can pretty much take a guess that some stuff may not necessarily be considered.
Yes,
hey,
Claude, I am working on that chapter.
if he gets a whole chapter, then I want to at least be in the footnotes somewhere. Very distressing.
You're in one of my footnotes.
That'll work. I'll take that. That's a partial victory. I think what you saw with the, and if you had a chance to see the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu's little statement a few days ago, a lot that you see with the Israelis, I think, is what you see from a professional point of view, is frustration. There's a lot of frustration on how do you exactly – it is a threat. There's one end of the spectrum. Remember the French put a limpet mine under the Rainbow Warrior in New Zealand. What was that, like 80 – in the 80s at some point?
Yeah.
And I think you also saw that from at a tactical point of view where the Israelis – had a tough nut they needed to crack, and everybody's read about non-lethal weapons, there's a big argument I think that has been answered now that you don't bring a paintball gun to a stick fight.
Right.
That they were very frustrated on how do we accomplish our mission without giving the enemy what they want, which in this case is a big STRATCOM success, which they've had. So. You brought up, and with a guy with an intel background, you can appreciate it. If we need to get hold of this threat and understand this threat, but this threat is civilian, is this another area where we need to, from a maritime perspective, learn to do what our ground warfare people have, is develop an intimate relationship with those civilian intelligence and clandestine organizations that are going to be able to tap in and then hopefully through whatever firewall exists presently, to get that information to us to work together. I see that as a huge gap, because you're not going to have military intel sources going after civilians.
Sure, absolutely. That has to be part. Integration of intelligence and intelligence sharing has to be part of maritime domain awareness. And one of the things that they're going to have to consider, there's a Russian 19th century nihilist, Sergei Nechayev, who wrote that it's not enough to kill an adversary, you must first dishonor him. I'd hate to end on this kind of note, but there is a glint of
I've worked
of
with
truth
people who think that way.
Well, actually about 5 years ago, former CIA director James Woolsey was testifying on Capitol Hill, and they asked him, well, how would you deal with Iran? And he said, I deal with Iran the same way that Team America dealt with Kim Jong-il. I can't take Kim Jong-il seriously on the world stage as much as I used to. And there's a kernel of truth in that. And I would recommend, if you want to read Sergei Nechayev's The Revolutionary, because some of the things that he wrote 150 years ago were adopted by the Black Panthers, the Red Brigade. And I would argue, even if they haven't read it, that some of these NGOs or NSAs are adopting the same things. He talked about infiltrating social formations, exploiting rich and influential people and subordinating them to the revolutionary, aggravating the miseries of the people, exhausting their patience, and inciting them to rebel. Well, we don't necessarily need to use the same tactics they do, but first we need to understand how they use them, but then play all of those things against them. Instead of infiltrating, let's play to our strength and expose them. Instead of exploiting, we inform people. Instead of aggravating people, we empower them. Instead of exhausting their energies, we energize them. And instead of inciting them, we need to inspire them. So there are some fundamental differences between us as a democracy, as a Western civilization, and the organizations which we may need to face in the future in terms of regular challenges. And I know we're pretty short on time.
Yeah, we're at about 1 minute. We got a book recommendation now. You can put it right next to Saul Alinsky's book and look at some of the good lessons there. Claude, we got about 50 seconds left here. I want to give you the last part of the show because we sold some of it. But just in case, I want to thank you very much for your patience also coming on today. We owe you an extra 20 minutes, and when you get closer to want to talk about your book, we ought to do that. So in about 30 seconds, what's the last tee-off you'd like for our listeners?
He wants to solve all the nation's problems.
in 30 seconds or less. That's message development, message delivery. I would have to echo what Brian said. We have a proper place in the maritime environment, and America as a sea power is a very good thing. We do good things and important things, and hope we need to have folks recognize that throughout the United States and the world.
Very well. Thank you very much, everybody. Have a good week and a great Navy Day.
Well done, Claude. Thanks.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it, guys. Sal, you still online?
I don't think you can cue the music either.
What's that?
I don't think you